Hi guys, and welcome back to the You Need Therapy podcast. My name is Kat, and if I sound a little bit under the weather, it's because, well, I am. And I actually had to cancel a couple interviews for the podcast due to me being sick and not feeling very good and sounding pretty bad, because you know there's nothing quite like listening to a podcast with somebody who sounds sick, which is unfortunate. And also at the same time, nothing you can really do about it. It's one of those things where it's like, well, can't really get mad at myself for something that just kind of happened naturally. And I was planning on sucking it up and putting out a new solo episode today until I was having a little talk with my friend Amy, who a lot of you guys know, Amy Brown. She has the podcast Four Things with Amy Brown, and I'm on her podcast network, the Amy Brown Podcast Network. And I was talking to her about, I was just talking about what I was doing, how I was feeling and working on the episode I was going to try to put out. And she was like, why are you doing that? She was like, you're sick. You should probably just rest. And when she said that, I was like, oh my gosh, you are very right. You are very, very right. I'm sick. I don't feel good. I really don't sound very good at all. And I am just like every other human in the world who deserves to have a sick day when I'm sick so my body can heal. So I'm going to do that. And what a beautiful way to practice what I preach here all the time, taking care of yourself and being kind to yourself and loving yourself well. And so I'm taking a sick day. I'm not going to put out a whole new episode. I decided to instead release one of my favorite episodes ever that came out around the same time last year. And if you haven't heard this one, I'm very excited for you to hear it, because it's literally, I'm not even kidding. And I try not to do this, but then I also do is like really rank these, but this is one of my favorite episodes. So if you haven't heard this, I'm very excited for you. And honestly, even if you have heard this episode before, I'm also excited for you to be tuning into it, because I've listened to it multiple times because it was that helpful for me to hear and rehear some of the things that Hannah said in this episode. So I'm going to lay on the couch and watch. I think I'm going to start that series Dope Sick on Hulu. I keep being told that I would like it, and so I'm going to finally give it a go. I just finished Ted Lasso, which I know I'm late to the party there, but I am obsessed and was very upset when there was no more episodes to watch. So I've done that already. I'm going to move on to Dope Sick, in case you guys were wondering. So I'm going to do that. You guys listen to this episode. I hope that you enjoy it. I hope that everybody is staying as healthy as you can out there. And here is my episode with Hannah Bruncher called Depression Does Not Define You. I have a very exciting guest that I have been really waiting patiently yet impatiently to talk to. Her name is Hannah Bruncher. She is a writer, a speaker, a TED talker, a mom and a wife, and all around, I think, good human. So I want to say thank you for being here, Hannah.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I was like, yeah, I can't wait for this. I just love the subject matter of this podcast.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Okay, so we're going to talk about all the things, yes, or as many things we can talk about in the time we have. But I want to start with, you have a new book coming out. Mm-hmm. I think when this is released, it'll be like the day the book comes out. So I got a copy and I've been reading it, but I want you, because it is a little bit, it reads different than your previous,
yes,
books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I want you to tell us a little bit about that book and what's important and what is special about it to you and kind of why you wrote it.
Yeah. So it is different, and it is intentionally different from the first two books that I wrote, especially Come Matter Here was very much my story. And I loved that and knew that story needed to be told, but I was really eager to write something like this where it could be just all about the reader. That's what I wanted it to be. I knew I couldn't give people the roadmap for their life or how to fix it, but I knew that, like, because of my own experiences, I have been in places where I have been stuck and unable to move forward. And I think we all have. And a lot of times that's fear holding us back. There's lies holding us back. In Come Matter Here, I dedicated a chapter to that. And I'm like, you got to dedicate a whole book to that, because like, it's not a one and done thing. You get over one hurdle and there's another hurdle. And so, mm-hmm, I realized in this that a lot of times we're not moving forward and we don't get to move forward or walk forward or run forward. A lot of times what we have to do is little by little fight forward. And so, yeah, I wrote what I called fight songs. They're these power-packed essays, very short and to the point, mm-hmm. to hopefully inspire people to get up and get moving and start living their lives rather than being a spectator in the lives of others.
Yeah. And I will say, I'm not through the whole thing, but I love the way it's written because I'm not somebody who can sit down and read for like hours.
Yes.
And it's like, I can read one story a night and there are specific ones that have already kind of spoken to me. Mm-hmm. And the one that I don't want to give anything away because I want people to read this, but the one I want to say that I have loved the most so far is the, I think it was like mile one?
Yes. Yep. It's mile one.
Oh, yes. It's right? So good. It's so good. And I think that, I mean, you could write a whole book on that chapter because basically what you're talking about is like, you got to start, right? And
yeah.
So many people can't start. So that is just to say the whole book is filled with like just almost like power packed messages that you can sit and get through and take and digest day by day, evening by evening.
You don't need to have read chapter 9 to get something from chapter 10 or to have read yeah. chapter 13 to go to 14. It's more so like all these different topics.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what I love about it. It's like, it's not that I didn't want to tell a story. I tell stories all throughout it, but I was really excited to just be yeah. like, where do we need to go and what needs to be helpful? And mm-hmm. let's hit that.
Yeah. Okay. So because you do talk so much about your story and your life and yeah. your writing, and I so far only know you from your writing, I would love if you could talk a little bit about more so, I mean, all of it, whatever you want to talk about, mm-hmm. but really more so your fight with depression.
Yeah.
You put out, I think it was last week or could have been the week before, but something on Instagram about coming out of the woods
coming
day.
Out of the woods today. Yeah.
Oh my God. That was such a good post. Like,
and I feel bad because I literally haven't had any time to even go and comment back to people because life has been so crazy. I did not expect that response from people. And I'm like, everyone needs a response. I'm going to be that weird person that shows up 2 weeks later to be like, hey, thanks for sharing.
They'll appreciate that, whatever. But I want to talk about that because you are very open with your story when it comes to mental health. And
yeah.
what I understand is that post represented like, hey, I didn't stay there forever. Mm-hmm. Like that happened. I fought through it. It still can come back and forth, but I didn't stay in that dark pit forever. And so I want to talk about and I want to hear from you what depression has looked like for you, what it has felt like for you
yeah.
and how you've experienced it in your life.
I mean, to go way back in the trenches to when I was born. No, I'm kidding. I think growing up, I was always a very anxious kid, like anxious about everything. And that has been used to my advantage because it also made me an achiever. But I didn't know at the time, like anxiety and depression are like sisters, you know, like one usually leads to the other and vice versa. And so I remember growing up and I always was anxious and we called it queasy. Like, I'm just queasy. I was queasy about going to school. I was queasy about being on a stage. And I got to the point where I graduated from college. I moved to New York City and I was living what I thought was supposed to be like my dream life. But very quickly, I fell into what I would now call situational depression. And so everything around me, like I had gone from a very small college where everybody knew my name, where I knew them, I had vibrant community to the one of the biggest cities in our country. And even though there's so many people, it's a very isolating city. It's very hard to connect with people in New York. It's possible. And I made it happen in a lot of ways, but I felt very lonely. I felt very disconnected. And it was just a very like jarring experience to go from where I was to this place in New York. I was living in the Bronx, New York. I was living on the third floor of an immigration center. So like you'd literally come downstairs in the morning and there would be people waiting for the center to open up because somebody had been deported in the middle of the night. Like it was a lot of intense things right in my face. And no one, they should have put a therapist in that program with me,
yeah.
but they didn't. And so I call it situational depression because I very much think that the situation I was in is what spurred on the depression and the sadness. And at the same time, I felt a lot of shame about depression. I didn't talk openly about it. I didn't know how to tell my friends and family about it. I think you could probably look at my face and know something is wrong, but I didn't know how to admit, like, hey, I'm not in a very good place right now. And when I moved away from New York and I took a job back home, it was almost like that depression, it just left. It was gone. And I thought, like, it was like the chicken pox. You deal with depression once, you will never deal with it again. That is not true. And so in 2014, I had moved to Atlanta. I had uprooted my life. I was on a new adventure. And everything from the outside of my life looked great. It looked awesome. I was speaking around the country. I was writing books. My first book was about to come out. I had given a TED talk. Like, everything was going for me. And it was everything that the world had kind of told me mattered. So I thought I was doing something right. Yes. I wasn't taking care of myself, I would say. I wasn't really having any kind of rest or care for my well-being. And I remember it was November of 2014. I actually remember where I was. I was at my co-working space. I remember going to a friend and saying to her, like, hey, like, I'm just not like doing well right now. You know, like, I actually, it was like a period of time where I didn't have a lot of work on my plate. And for me, I didn't know how to deal when I didn't have a lot of work on my plate, because that meant I would have to be like alone with my thoughts. And I didn't really want to be in that space, right? And I remember that we went in another room and she was praying for me. And after she prayed for me, she was talking to me. And I don't even remember what she was saying, because all I remember is this sharp pain that came from the top of my head down to my feet, came over my entire body. I actually physically felt it. And from that point forward, it was like I was in a paralysis. Like, doctors were trying to figure out what had happened. And the best that they could say was that, like, I'd had a nervous breakdown. I actually was able to, like, meet with a cerebral neurologist, like, a few years removed from this situation. And he was like, oh, it's so evident to me what happened to you. He was like, you were going at such a breakneck pace. And at the same time, like, we have these two parts of our brain. We have the right side and we have the left side. And he was like, you were leaning so much on emotions and empathy, but not physical, practical things and things you needed to do in your life to take care of you, that side of your brain just shut down completely. It was like the CEO and the COO and the CFO all quit on the same day. Yeah. And the only person left to run your brain was the guy in the mailroom. And he's like, and the guy in the mailroom, you don't want running your brain, because he's like Chicken Little on crack. And it was like, that's what happened. Like, literally Chicken Little on crack was running my brain, where I was paranoid about everything. I was fearful of everything. I was having panic attacks. Like, it's still so hard for me to explain to people what that was, because it was the scariest time of my life. It was the darkest time of my life. And it was very much like I did not feel like I was in control of my own brain. Like, I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I almost felt like I would go in and out of these moments of clarity. Like, I would have these brief moments in my day where I could see everything clearly, where I could know that I was fighting this battle, where I felt like my brain and my mind were clear. And then it was only a matter of time before another rumination took me and I was back in the pit. That's the best way that I can describe it. I hope it makes sense. But to the point that I actually started to keep a Word document up on my computer. And in the times where I felt clarity, I would write a note to myself so that I would find it when I was back in the pit. And it was like a breadcrumb to be like, Hannah, you're going to come out of this. I saw it clearly. You will come out of this. You got to keep going. Because once you're in that pit with those ruminations, like, you're not even thinking rationally. Mm-mm. Like, you're just believing whatever lie is thrown at you next. And so I fought my way through this for 4 months. It was incredibly dark and incredibly hard. I was hospitalized at one point. And I remember the hospital was one of the times that I felt the most relief, because I thought, like, maybe they'll just leave me here. Like, maybe I can be done and I won't have to do this ever again. I won't have to use my brain again, because it was the time where I've never been somebody who contemplated suicide. I've never thought it through. But I remember in that hospital bed being like, I get it. I totally get why people do this, because I just want the pain to stop. And I'm thankful I didn't give up there. I'm thankful that I decided that I was going to pursue more doctors. I was going to take on medication. I was going to take back my life, but it was not an overnight thing. I slowly but steadily started to rebuild my life, and I had to rebuild my life to look different than how it had looked before. I had to learn to take care of myself. I had to learn to fuel myself differently. I had to accept that I was going to go to therapy regularly, that it wasn't going to be like a one and done thing, and that I might be on medication for my life. I don't know, but I do know that because I take medication today, I'm able to show up and thrive in the way that God needs me to show up. And so to me, I look at it and I'm removed from what happened in 2014, but I fight the battle every single day. And I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful that I get this opportunity. That sounds weird to be like, depression is a gift. I don't necessarily think depression is a gift, but I also think had I not gone through this, I would have never been able to know how to open the door for other people that are stuck in the woods.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. One, there are there's so many things in there that I'm like, yes, yes, yes. Specifically, I want to go back to the beginning because I wonder what it looked like on the outside, because this happened after you had a lot of success, quote unquote, success in a career. And there's sometimes we can get depressed because things aren't working out the way we want them to work, or we aren't able to rise on certain occasions and get certain like materialistic things we want. And so it feels empty. But you had what I assume on the outside, a lot of quote unquote success.
Yeah.
And so what was it like for you to be in that spot before you went to this doctor and explained what's going on in your brain of like, why am I feeling this way?
Well, because it was, and this is not in like a toot your horn.
Yeah.
It was the most success in the smallest amount of time. Like,
yeah,
giving a TED talk, like that's the ultimate. And one
and that
day,
was 6 years ago, TED talk, like, so huge, huge deal.
Yes, exactly. Right. When TED was like,
And
it went online and my life literally flipped upside down within a matter of 24 hours. Book agents, movie agents, like everything was happening. All of a sudden I went from not speaking at all to speaking everywhere in the country, conferences, colleges. I mean, it was wild and it was amazing, but it was almost like, I think back and I think I experienced a lot of that at such a rapid rate and at such a young age, just to realize it's not there. It's like, if you're striving for that, it's not going to fill you. And like, there are definitely ways to be proud of that success and proud of working hard, but it won't fill the emptiness inside of you if you feel it. That's something that has to be filled by, to me, planting down some kind of roots, having community around you, having balance, taking care of yourself, or like realizing like, you might experience the success, but you are not the be all end all and you're not holding the world together. Because like, from the outside, it all looked perfect. I thought it was perfect. I thought that whatever this emptiness was that was kind of looming in the background, I'm like, maybe we all just feel it, you know? But I just remember having this very crazy experience too after everything broke and I had been in it for a few months and I went to the hospital and then they told me to go to an inpatient program in Connecticut. Now, I was living in Atlanta at the time, but I was basically fighting for my life in Connecticut because that's where my family was. My mom was there. My friends that knew me were there. I'd moved to Atlanta and not planted any roots down, so I couldn't be surprised that these people didn't know how to fight through this life-threatening thing with me. Mm-hmm. But I remember sitting in the waiting room of this inpatient program and I just wanted to scream because I wanted to be like, why am I here? Like, what is going on? Like, I'm successful. I'm doing things. Like, I don't need to be here right now. But like, that wouldn't have made any difference. That wasn't the right perspective at that time. But I just remember being like, how did I get here? And I kept trying to explain to every doctor, like, no, you don't understand. Like, I swear, like, I'm a functioning adult. I do these things, you know, like, I wanted to prove myself. And there was this one doctor at the end of that day, because we went from office to office to paperwork. And I told my mom, I'm like, I'm not doing this. I don't know why you guys have me here. I'm not doing this. I have a therapist in Atlanta. I'm not going to be here in this program. Like, the therapist that they paired me with, she was not empathetic at all. She was not nice at all. I was like, I don't know why we're here, but fine, we'll follow through. And we get to the end of the day to this woman who was basically, I don't know, going to diagnose me. I'm not even sure what was happening at that point, but she had me like explain a little bit about my life. And so I'm telling her all this about my life. And, you know, I'm like puffing it up real big. Cause like, I gotta let her know.
Like, hey, I'm good.
I'm good. And she was just like, oh, well, like I could have seen that crash coming from a mile away, girl. Like you are taking on way too much in a way short amount of time. And your capacity broke. Like you just broke. And, you know, we came up with some solutions after that. And I would say after that point, that was when it started to like move slowly upwards. I started to see some like clearing in the woods, you know, but I don't even know. Like I just.
Well, you bring up something that's really important, I think, to talk about. And that is hustle culture. I can't wait to hear your perspective on this because there is so much of that right now. So much. I'm seeing a little bit of decline of that, like power, hustle, do the work, don't take a break. But a lot of, especially even self-help kind of stuff, is like hustle culture, like go do it, like get up and go make it happen. And so what is it like? That might have been the height of hustle culture. Like, what is it like?
What is it like? Hustle culture.
Right. The prime of both. So what is it like for somebody to be struggling with depression and the crash of hustle? I mean, the hustle culture didn't work for you. You did it.
Yeah. Hustle culture is interesting to me because there is still part of me that loves the hustle. I love it.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to glorify it. And I think, you can hustle all you want, but like, you got to know that hustling does not just mean work. It means like you need to take care of all these aspects of you, because like right now, like I am in one of the busiest seasons of my life. And there have been a few moments where I've said to my husband, I feel like I cannot breathe right now, but then I recenter myself and I remember, okay, here are the things that are on my list. Here are the ways that I'm taking care of myself. And these ways that I'm taking care of myself, they have to come first. If I want to do any of this stuff, I need to do these things first. And for me, those are my foundational tools. That's my fueling my body with the right foods, staying hydrated, getting my workout in, being in the word of God, staying surrounded by my community. Those are my pillars. And I didn't have those before. I just had my hustle and I wondered why I wasn't fueled. And so I think that like, I kind of toe a line because I also don't resonate with the culture that's like, namaste in bed. Cause it's like, get up and do something, you know? Like we can't be all or nothing in this.
Yes. Yeah. And that's, I think that, I mean, there's a whole other avenue of like, it's black or white. It's like, you're doing everything or you're doing nothing. And
exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm more so like, we got work to do. We got to get some things done, but also it's not going to matter if you lose yourself in the process, if you don't know how to take care of yourself. And so like, I might have a busy day, a busy week, and I still am like, okay, but like, how can I fuel my body today? I don't want to do this workout, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to see my therapist. I'm going to take my medication. All of these things, they matter if I want to show up at full capacity. And I found that like by doing those things that like might quote unquote, like take hours out of your day. No, like they just actually expand the amount of capacity and time that you have, or it turns out that you don't need nearly as much time to work efficiently as you did because you're fueling your brain. You're fueling, you know, like you're taking care of yourself. Yeah. So you can actually operate at a higher capacity, be more efficient in less time so that you have time to take a break, rest, be with your family, whatever it is that fuels you up.
Yeah, I love that perspective. And hopefully we can influence some people to take that on because we are in this black or white. I wonder for you to go back to how you even got to the hospital. Like, I want to go back and hear what brought you to that level of, I need help. Were you aware? Was it somebody telling you to go? How did you get there?
Other people sent me to the hospital. For sure.
Okay.
People showed up at my house and was like, she needs to go to the hospital. Like they told my mom, you got to drive her to the hospital. Like we were scared, you know, and not scared in the sense of like, I wasn't going to do anything crazy, but we had, we tried everything else. I was seeing a therapist and there's only so much you can see a therapist. I wish you could like lock yourself in a room with them for 6 hours in the day and like really deal with some stuff. But like, we had exhausted our efforts and there was nothing changing. Yeah. And I mean, yeah. I was pumped to go to the hospital. I know that sounds so weird, but I remember getting into that room and feeling like maybe somebody's going to take care of me now. Like maybe I can just shut off my brain for a little bit. Like I get emotional because my brain was just so tired and I felt like I was in such a dark space. I didn't know at the time, like the science behind ruminations, you know, and I was exhausted and I just wanted somebody to be able to just lift that off of me and be like, you don't need to move. You don't need to do anything. You can just give up. And of course they didn't give me that option. They just gave me a really expensive bill. But, but I think that like, I look at my journey and I look at like the different things that happened and like, not all of it makes sense, you know, like that hospital visit, all of that. Like I look back and I'm like, I don't even know what the purpose of that was, but it all led me to the recovery that I experienced, you know? And I think that there's no shame in going to a hospital. There's no shame in asking for help, you know? And I think that's what I didn't know how to do. I knew how to ask for help to an extent, but like, I was not the person to say, I have to go to the hospital. It was people that were like, hey, like, because we love you, we want to go figure out like what's going on. You've been to doctors. And I had doctors too, that like were, gosh, like giving me all kinds of medications that I really wish somebody had vetted or been like, hey, because like at one point a doctor gave me benzos and I didn't know anything about benzos except that like my brother, who has been an addict for the last 17 years, was addicted to benzos, you know? And so what no one told me about them is that you would take a pill and you would calm down, but then the crash was like 10 times harder. And so I was self-sabotaging in that way of like, I just was doing the best I could to just maintain. And so me being in Connecticut and me choosing to go to the hospital and then like entertain this idea of an inpatient program was me saying, I'm willing to stay in one place and do the work to figure this out. Because it was just a lot of craziness.
And you know, you talked about like voices and just how like your brain didn't, it was like the mailman was running your brain. Like it just wasn't you. And so one, I just want to make the point to say to everybody listening, this is a very weirdly beautiful, I don't really know how to call it, picture of successful people needing help too. And people that are doing well and getting their, reaching their goals. We all need help. And there's no shame in that. We're all human. No matter how successful you are, you're still a human being.
Doesn't make you weak.
No, no, not at all. And I want to know what voices the mailman guy had in, running through your brain, right? So you always had anxiety. You always had that, you knew.
Yeah.
And so was this a totally different voice or was it like a louder version of some of those voices? And what did they say?
Yeah, it was like anxiety on like steroids, you know? Everything, every lie that you could imagine suddenly just like popping up all over the place. So yeah, like it was the standard things of like, you don't matter. It doesn't matter that you're here. You don't need to be here. You're not enough. All of that. But like, it was the only thing that I could hear. And I think that, and like, this is something I actually do not talk about a lot. We're going to go there, right?
Okay, let's go there. I want to go there.
I think what happens is that anxiety and fear, and I'm not a professional, so I cannot say that this is what happens. You can let me know.
Okay.
But I think that like ruminations, you can fixate on a certain thing and you can become obsessed with that thing and it will take you all the way down, right? And so at the time, I had just finished writing my first book and that book had been my obsession. I'd poured all my energy into it because it was the only thing I had ever wanted to do my whole entire life was write a book. So, I mean, I was up with the sun writing that book, sun went down, still writing that book. And then I let it go. I gave it to the editor and it was over and there was nothing left for me to do. Very soon after, that depression came on. And so for me, it was a lot of these lies and these fears, but there was also this obsession that something was wrong with the book. I didn't know what it was, but I would spend hours trying to figure it out. Like I lost hours in a single day just sitting there trying to figure it out. And I had people around me being like, Hannah, It has nothing to do with the book. The book is over. The book is done. We need to let it go. But anybody that's ever felt a rumination, it's like you have to obsess on this one thing. And the thing about ruminations is that they're not problems you can solve, but you're convinced that you can solve them. And so what's so interesting about that is that for weeks, I was obsessed with that book and figuring out what was wrong with it, to the point that now that book is out there in the world. It has blessed many people. I still to this day have a hard time looking at it. I have a hard time going back and reading through it because it was associated with that very dark depression. And I know there's nothing wrong with the book, but like you spend so much time ripping something apart, you feel like you have nothing left at the end of it. And so that's something that a lot of people do not know. And that's something that honestly, like talking about it, you feel a little bit like mad. The brain is such a powerful thing that I think that I don't have any rationale for why it was like that. That's just the reality of what was happening for me.
When you say I feel mad, what does the mad say? Like, what are you mad for or mad about?
No, I mean like mad as in like kind of like Mad Hatter, like crazy.
Oh, crazy.
But okay. I don't like to say the word crazy because I don't want anyone to. Yeah. So I said mad.
Okay. I'm like, okay. Well, okay. So totally. And that is something that can be looked at across so many different avenues of our lives. If we think something enough and we tell a story to ourselves enough times, which that's what you're doing with that rumination, something's wrong with the book, something's wrong with the book, something's wrong with the book, you better believe that you're going to think something's wrong with the book. And that's this, we can do that to our body. Something's wrong with my body. Something's wrong with my body. Nobody will love me. Yep. Nobody will love me. Whatever we tell ourselves over and over again is what we end up believing. And we create stories. There's two sides to that. That's awesome. And one side, because I can tell myself I'm great. I can tell myself I'm beautiful. I can tell myself that people love me and I'm wanted. But for some reason, that's usually not what we do.
It takes a long time to get to that space.
Oh, yeah. And so we can tell ourselves any story, but a lot of times we're telling ourselves the story that something's wrong with us or there's something wrong with what we've done, which makes me think of, I learned this as an intern. I was reading one of Brené Brown's books, I don't know how long ago, and I don't even know which of her books it was, but she talked about how we get dopamine, which is a feel-good chemical in our bodies, in our brains, when we figure things out. And so what we do is we're meaning-making people. Humans like stories, and we like to have our stories to have an ending. And so we figure things out and we make up reasons for things and we make up ends of stories that quite possibly are not true because it feels good when we figure it out. The problem is, just like the medication, it's great. And then the come down is so bad.
Well, something else is going to come in that place. Right. Like once I had solved a rumination, another one always popped up until I got smart and was like, whoa, this is going to keep happening until I tear apart my whole entire life.
Right. Yes. Because it's like something's wrong with the book. Okay. Now I have to do something to fix that. And then what? And we do that with the example I always give to people is because a lot of the, I see mostly women in their like 20s, 30s, 40s, a lot of them struggling with relationships and all of that. And it's like when you're texting somebody, you're texting a guy, you're talking to a guy, specifically maybe on a dating app, because that's what we do these days.
Yep.
And it's a back and forth and we're talking and we're, it's great. And we're like getting along. And then you say something and he has the dot, dot, dots, and then they go away.
Yes.
And then he doesn't finish. You never hear from him. And it's like an hour goes by and then another hour goes by. And then you start thinking, what did I do? Well, did I say, was my punctuation weird? Like, should I not have said that? Was it not funny? Do you think he understood what I said? And in reality, like maybe he's like in the shower. Maybe he got a phone call from his mom. Maybe he dropped his phone in the toilet. Who knows? He could be doing anything. But we gravitate to the story that says something is wrong with us.
Well, and I've already been somebody who's prone to do that in daily life, not in the relationship set. Like I'm in a very happy marriage, but like I'll be the person that will like be at like a friend's house or whatever. And we're having like deep conversation and I'm vulnerable. I'm just a vulnerable person, but then I'll leave and I'll be like, should I have said that? Like, should I have said that? You know? And then you text the person to be like, hey, I'm so sorry if I said something, you know? And like, every friend always comes back and is like, what are you talking about? Like, stop, just stop. But like, I'll overthink things. And so I think when your brain is not in a good place, like mine wasn't, it was like what I normally would do just on overdrive, yeah. You know?
I think so many of us are like that. We like get really vulnerable and then we're like, ugh. And then we have shame for being vulnerable. I should have done that when like the world really needs more of that. Like that's what people are really.
I'm texting you after the podcast and I'm like, oh gosh, did I go too far, you know?
You're like, can we take all of that out? How about we? But I've done that. The first time I recorded, it was the very beginning of this podcast, and I will put my story, parts of pieces of my story on my Instagram and stuff like that. And my friends can know things, but I recorded an episode where somebody was asking me about my life, and I spent days chopping it up and moving things around, taking things out. And then I'm like, can we redo it? And so we sat down to redo it. We start recording. And my friend was like, I'm not doing this. She was like, this is so inauthentic. There's nothing wrong with what we did the first time. You just need to relax. And I'm like, okay. And then it ended up being a great episode.
Yes.
Like, there's nothing wrong with it. And I love that we connect in that way. On track, I want to know what you wish most people knew about mental health or depression. What do you think out there is either a myth, or what do you think more people understood? Coming from a place where I've like been through the trenches of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It's really hard. I don't know. I think it's a great thing that we are maybe more so shining a light on mental health. Like, I'm glad that we're talking about it more. You know, 10 years ago when I first dealt with depression, I didn't feel like it was talked about at all. Mm-mm. I think though, at the same time, like I wish that maybe we had some better language to communicate what it is that we're feeling, because a lot of people in daily life are just like, I'm depressed. And like, depression is a real thing. Like, it's a very real thing. And it was something that I thought was going to like take my life or be the end of my life. And I would love to have language to be able to find those people that are really struggling. It is not to belittle what anybody is going through, but like, there are people whose lives are hanging in the balance who are in the same spot that I was in, where I was like, I don't know how to get out and I am scared for my life. And the more that we just use language to just be like, I feel depressed today, you know, it's like, there's a difference like between that depression and then that severe depression. Mm-hmm. So that's something just off the top of my head. But I mean, I think too that like, I also have seen this thing, and I've seen it in the last few years, and I find it to be really interesting that a lot of times we take something like depression or anxiety and we build an identity out of it. And to me, that's fascinating, because I would never want to say that my anxiety is my defining factor, or depression is my defining factor. And I think we have to be really careful with that, because in a lot of ways, we are saying like, the essence of me and the core of me is that I'm stuck in a depressive pit. And it's fine to identify with that. I will tell anyone I deal with depression. But again, my language that I use is very intentional. I don't say I struggle with depression. I say I deal with depression. That is something that I do every single day. And it means that I, as much as depression is a hard thing in my life, it doesn't take my identity. It is not who I am. I bring way more to the table than my mental illness. And I find it interesting to find people who's like, depression is their Instagram bio. Depression is how they identify themselves on Twitter. And I want to say like, no, don't give it that credit. Like, you can't give it that credit. Like, it's a hard battle. Yes. And you should tell your story, but like, there is far more for you in this lifetime than your depression. And so I always have to kind of toe that line, because I know people love that I talk about mental health, but like, at the end of the day, I am not my depression. Like, my depression does not have that hold on me.
Well, that's not where your story starts or ends.
Yeah. But a lot of people let it stay there, and they stay in that depression for years. And I would want somebody to know, like, you can get out of this. I believe that you can get out of this. And there are going to be good days and hard days. And maybe you try different medications and one works and one doesn't work. But like, you have to keep making those steps.
When I think that I see that all the time.
Yeah.
I saw it a lot when I worked in a residential treatment center, when people, it was just like, it's not that they didn't want to get out of something, but you somewhat become addicted to it.
Yep.
Because for some people, gives them certain things. It might give them, and this is not to say this is what everybody does, but I have seen where it gives somebody an identity where they haven't had an identity. It gives somebody a way to get connection because people are worried about them, or it allows people to not do the hard, scary thing that's been looming in the back of their head forever. And so we get addicted. It's so backwards, and people are so confused when I bring it up to them because they're like, what? No, I would never do that. I would never want this. And I'm like, well, I think you might, because I think it might be giving you something or helping you do something that you think you can't do without this.
It can operate as a really great excuse too. And like, that's not to like belittle where people are on the map.
No.
Like, it would be much easier to say, well, I don't, I have depression, so I can't do this. I have anxiety, so I can't get on stage. And like, I mean, I speak around the country all the time. Well, not in the COVID world, but you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
And I want people to know, like, I have pretty big anxiety when it comes to being on stage. There, I would rather be anywhere else in the world than on stage. But just because I have that anxiety does not mean that anxiety is going to change the outcome of what I intend to do. I will still show up. I will still do what I am called to do, because that anxiety does not get to have the final say.
Yeah. Like, it's not, it, you're not letting it be somewhat of a robber. And I look at anxiety a lot of times as it's a fancy word for fear for some people. That's how it operates.
Yep.
And when we feel fear around things that we care about.
Yeah.
So I have more anxiety than most people I know, but I'm the same way of like, what am I going to do? Not do anything, or look at it as I'm scared of this because it is so important to me.
Mm, I'm scared of it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So I love that. And then the other part you said right before that, when you were talking about you almost using those words too much right now, it's like, it's funny and I enjoy parts of it on social media, but like anxiety is a big joke. Like it's just it's one big meme joke. And I like that we're talking about it.
Yeah.
And I like that we're talking about depression and anxiety. And at the same time, there is a difference between feelings and a mental illness.
Yes.
And it's not a fine line. Like, everybody has feelings and not everybody suffers from anxiety and depression.
Yeah.
And so I agree with you. And I don't even know how to change that. I don't know how to fix that.
Yeah.
But I totally agree with you there. 100%. And for you, how do you identify the difference between being somebody who has struggled with, you have feelings, and then you've also been in this realm of I'm suffering from depression and real clinical anxiety? How have you been able to differentiate between I'm sad and this is more than sadness?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, like, to me, the outcomes are both the same of what I need to show up to do. Like, that doesn't change. So like, for instance, I had a baby 7 months ago, and I knew I was at a much higher rate for postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. And your hormones are up, they're down, they're everywhere. And I prepared, I kind of like created my battle plan for like, what is going to happen if I do have postpartum? And like, if you, when you have a baby, like, they'll give you all these, like they'll give you like this timeline of like, oh, on day 5 to 7, you might feel this and da 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 da. So I was in that part where this was these are the days where you're going to cry the most, and you are just going to cry for no reason at all. And like, I remember those days because I was terrified of like, is this it? Do I have postpartum? Like, am I in this? Like, are we going to do this for the next 7, 8 weeks? Cause I'm not somebody who like, and I'll say this very openly, I was not somebody who immediately Novalee came out of me, they put her on top of me, and I felt all the love in the world. That didn't happen for me. I was more like, what the heck just happened? Like, I just had a baby, and that was very traumatic. And I felt guilty the first few weeks of her life that I was not obsessed with her, that every breath she took wasn't like the most radiant thing I'd ever experienced.
Yeah.
But I talked to a lot of friends that being able to have these conversations, I was realizing, oh, wait, no, like I'm in the right place. We just don't have these conversations. We just don't talk about this, that like my love for her will grow over time, just as it does other humans. Like, it was actually my therapist that was the one that gave me the most clarity on that. And she's like, if you came to me and you were like, I'm obsessed with my baby, I would probably say, what's going on really? Because that's not how you approach anything in life.
Yeah.
Any relationship that you have, it is a slow build over over time. So why would you expect for this to be different?
I'm so glad you said that. I'm so glad you said that, because nobody talks about that.
People will talk about
postpartum, but to be able to say, I didn't feel that thing that we're quote unquote supposed to feel.
The thing that we write the Instagram caption about.
Right.
She came and I've never felt a love like this. And I was like, did I do something wrong? Because like, I love her for sure. I love her. But like, I am very much kind of like, what is happening? I'm not sleeping. My body does not look like my body. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah. What's it like for you to say that?
To admit all of that.
Yeah. I mean, you've processed it with a therapist, but what's it like for you to say that?
I mean, I feel like, I guess, good. I mean, I think too, like, I still though, like, this is one of the first times that I've actually like vocalized that. And I've learned throughout my journey of motherhood that if I just say what I'm honestly feeling and what I felt the whole time and just been honest, I actually am giving a lot of people permission to feel like they can do the same. And that's been very surprising to me, I guess, because for me, having been somebody who deals with depression, knowing I'm at a higher rate for postpartum, I planned for what it was going to look like afterwards. I'm somebody who, you know, I made the decision not to breastfeed, not because I don't believe in the benefits of breastfeeding, but because I believed that was actually going to be a very stifling, unhealthy experience for me, that I was going to feel very isolated. And I, every day, am so thankful I knew myself enough to make that choice. And if anything, I would say to moms, like, make the choice that is going to allow you to show up to be the best version of yourself for that baby. Because America is one of the only countries that like puts the mom in the background. Like in all these other countries, we pay attention to the fact that you just carried a life for 9 months. If you don't think that's going to have an effect on your body, your hormones, your well-being, like we need more support for moms in that. And I think that like maybe because when I was at that point where I thought, oh my gosh, is this postpartum? Did it just show up? I had this moment of clarity where I was able to say, Hannah, if this is postpartum and this is the long haul, is it going to look any different than what you are showing up to do right now? And the answer was no. I had my battle plan in place. I knew what I was supposed to be doing. I needed the foods that I needed to eat. I needed to move my body. I needed to be in the word. I needed to stay surrounded. All of that was going to be put into practice, whether I had to fight the hard battle or not. And like, thankfully, I didn't have to fight that battle, but the battle plan still would have been in place. And so with the question that you had asked about like between the sadness and then the actual depression, the remedy is always the same. You know, it's always, okay, I can usually, if I'm going through kind of a pit, like a time where I'm feeling pretty somber, I can usually look at my life and say, what's off balance right now? Of those things, what am I neglecting? Okay, let's refocus in on that. And usually that's the missing piece for me.
Yeah. Oh, I like that of like the experiences can be very different, but the remedy is somewhat the same. Sometimes you need more of something, but also that sadness that you feel can be sadness can just be a feeling that you have and that's okay to have it. But if you're having a long-standing sadness, it could be a red flag for you're about to go down this road. Hey, where are all your things? Are you doing all your things?
Are you doing all your things? And my mom will call me and be like, are you doing all your things? And I'm like, no, I'm not. Like I'm eating like crap or like, no, I had some wine last night. And so I probably feel really depressed today because like my body's just more sensitive and I need we need to know our bodies. And for me, as somebody who is a Christian, that's been a battle I've had to fight because I think in the Christian community, it can very easily be, if you just have faith, it all works out. And I'm like, hold up. No. Like, I believe that like God designed us all very differently, meaning what works for you is not always going to work for me. Like I know myself well enough to know I have lower serotonin levels. And so I need to show up physically to figure out how to remedy that thing. It is not just faith that is going to pull me from this pit. And so that's where I spend a lot of my time trying to like squash the myths that come with like faith and mental health.
Thank you for saying that because I'm also a Christian. And that's one of the things that I've loved about your writing is the combination of your story and your relationship with your faith along this. And for you, has that shifted and changed? And what have you learned? This is a question that I'm very curious about. What have you learned about God through your journey with your mental health? Like, what have you learned about that relationship?
So much. I mean, yeah. So much. I attribute a lot of like coming out of this to God and his yeah. grace, but also a lot of hard work and a lot of people that God led me to. God led me to my therapist. Mm-hmm. He led me to my psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And I think what I've learned, the biggest thing that I've learned, is that God at the end of the day is not a feeling. You either believe that God is who he says he is, or you believe that like he left out the back door in the middle of the night and didn't come back, right? And that's because your feelings tell you that. And so for me, I used to operate my faith based on my feelings, and it never really did me well. Like, it's great when you're feeling awesome and amazing and like God is good, and then you're in the pit and you think God is not there, and that's just because your feelings are telling you that. But like, mm-hmm. my friend told me when I was going through this depression, she was just like, you know, like the way that you show up to fight changes based on what you believe about God in this circumstance. And she was like, mm-hmm. I've noticed, I've watched you. And she's like, and when you are confident that God is bringing you out of this, you show up and you fight. And then when you stop thinking that God is here, you fall right back into that pit. And that mm-hmm. was a mindset shift. And I really had to retrain my brain and retrain my mind. And that is not a one and done thing. Mm-hmm. I am still in the process of doing that. But like, mm-hmm. I think what I've learned about faith is that it's not this conceptual thing that we think it is. The Bible is actually a very practical book. There is a lot of things to be put into practice. Like, for example, taking every thought captive, that is a mental health thing right there. It is like, no, you need to look at your thoughts. You need to place them down on the page, wherever it is that you can examine them, and you need to figure out how to change those thoughts, rehearse better truths to you. And like, I think about David, who was definitely depressed. And a lot of those Psalms are like, whoa, dude, like somebody needed Lexapro. but I feel like I say that. You don't even need to take that out because I believe that in my core. But you can read the Psalms and be like, he is up, he is down, he is up, mm-hmm. he is down. And in Psalm 42, he literally says, why are you downcast, oh my soul? And we know that. Mm-hmm. We know that verse. We've heard that mm-hmm. verse. But in actuality, like, look what he's doing. He's literally talking to his mm-hmm. soul. He's having some mm-hmm. soul talk to be like, hey, what's going on inside of you? Like, what's up? And I think that that's important for people that deal with mental illness to realize there needs to be some separation between the things you think and the truth, you know? So sometimes I need to have that soul talk with myself to be like, Hannah, what is going on? Like, you mm-hmm. are sad right now. Like, what, mm-hmm. like, let's talk about this. Let's approach this from a different angle. I'm not just going to assume because I am sad, that's it. I'm sad for the rest of my life. So yeah, I just think that there's so much in the Word of God that is for everyday life. It is not mm-hmm. a book that was written thousands of years ago that's like good for like a verse to go on a coffee cup. I'm like, guys, this book is so rich and nuanced and crazy and weird. And like, I wish we could appreciate it for that.
Yes. Yeah. I wish we could just take that and like make it into like a something that people see on a billboard. Yes. There's so much passion in what you just said. That was amazing.
Take the episode, David needed Lexapro.
That's I maintain what it's called.
It. You would probably say, right? Can you agree with me?
Yes. Like, I think so.
He's good and then he is not good, all in a single sentence.
Oh my God, that was great. But you know what? I just appreciate all that so much, because I think a lot of there's a couple things that I was thinking in my head as you were going. But one is, we are told pray more, or have more faith, or do that. And it's like, okay, there is action that comes with that. It's that story. Have you heard that story about the guy who's like, there's a flood and he's like on top of a house. He's praying to God to come save him. And a boat passes by and is like, hey, come hop in my boat. And he's like, no, God's going to save me.
Yeah.
So the guy leaves, and then a helicopter comes down and he drops a rope and he's like, grab on here, we'll take you to land. And he's like, no, God's going to save me. And then he dies, gets to heaven, is like, God, why didn't you save me? He's like, I sent you a boat and a helicopter. What? And it's like, we pray. Yeah. We pray and we have faith, and then we do the work.
And that was huge in this fight, like through that 4 months. I just remember, cause like it was very nuanced with people in the mental health community, and then this faith aspect of it, because there was a pocket of people that believed if I just prayed and had faith and repented of whatever was inside of me, I was going to be better. Mm-hmm. And there were so many things that, like, me and my mom look back on and we're like, what the crap was that all about? Like, what, why did that even happen? Like, that doesn't even serve a purpose in the story. Yeah. But we chalk it up to, you know, it was just another way to say to God, hey, I'm going to continue stepping. I'm going to keep moving. I know this might seem crazy, but I'm desperate right now to move out of this pit. Cause like at one point I like drove to Massachusetts with a friend who was sure that this woman in Massachusetts could heal me. And this lady like led me through some repentance process for like ex-boyfriends, and it was weird. And I'm like sitting at the Cheesecake Factory in Massachusetts, like, what is happening in my life right now? What is going on? But I look back and I think, okay, but like, yeah. I was willing to say, I'll go there, God, because this might be the thing. Who knows? It wasn't.
Yeah, it was not.
Because I very much believe in therapists and
thank you.
Mental, yes, I believe in doctors that went to school for these things. But
yeah,
there are plenty of people too, though, that have prayed and have felt a miracle from God and have been healed instantly. But I think we have to be really careful to understand that might be somebody's story, but that might not be your story. And I mean, I even got a message from a girl months ago that just was like, I just have to let you know, like, you're not leaning on the full faith of the Lord. My depression was healed instantly and yours could if you believed more. And I just was like, hold up, chick. You don't want to go here with me. Cause like, I'm not mad about this for myself. I'm mad about this for the people you might say this to, and then they think they're broken and they're damaged and God is not showing up for them. My God has shown up at every juncture for me. And if I am still walking this out, that just means that God thinks I am someone to be partnered with in these unfinished stories. Like, I get very passionate about
that. Well, I even am like getting like teary eyed because I'm like, yeah, your story is a miracle still. Your just story involved different steps, but it's still a miracle that you went from feeling what you were feeling to where you are now. Like, that's still, it's just a different kind of miracle. So yeah.
And I think that's like something just like that's important to say overarchingly is that people say very well-meaning intentioned things to people that have depression or mental illness, but like sometimes this is not the invitation to come in and tell them all the things that they need to do. Mm-hmm. Like, I think if you are close with someone, if you are walking with somebody through the thick of it, you will know when the door is cracked open to say, hey, I think maybe you should try this.
Yeah.
But I think you just can't show up, be like, hey, do this, 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 get it right. Come on, let's go. Like, it doesn't work that way. That actually ends up being a lot more harmful than it is good.
Yeah. I'm sorry that person said that to you.
It's okay. I mean, she didn't have a leg to stand on. I wasn't.
Did you respond? You responded to her? Or no?
I responded to her, but then I muted her and I told her I'm going to mute you because I think this is actually really damaging. And I hope that you're going to relook at your messaging for this because she was not relenting. She did not want a conversation with me because she kept coming back at me. And I was just like, not today, Satan.
Yeah, no, I don't need this. Like, gosh. Well, and then the other thing that I was thinking about when you were talking about the difference between like feelings and faith is you have talked about in your books, I think it was Come Out or Here, but I don't know. I could have read this 2 days ago where you talk about there's a difference between having a feeling and hearing God. And
that was probably Come Out or Here.
Okay.
But maybe both.
I swear it was you. I swear it's you. So
sounds like me.
Yeah. That is important because I think a lot of times we're looking for God to say go, or God to say stay, or God to say marry him, or God to say divorce him. And we can have feelings all day long and it doesn't mean that God is saying yes, no, left, right. You have to be able to differentiate them. I don't know if I'm totally there, but it's not every time you don't hear something or feel something, or every time you feel something, it's not always something from the Lord above saying, do this.
Well, we have to be careful with that because I think a lot of people take it in the opposite direction of like, I heard God say this. God said this. God said this. You're going to be my husband. And it's like,
oh God,
that's insane. And that honestly, to me, that terrifies me because I think that's the reason that a lot of people walk away from faith to begin with is because they thought they heard God so clearly and then it didn't work out how they thought it was. And I think we have to be very careful because I do believe that God speaks, but I also think that like the things we hear him speak, they need to be tested. They need to be like vetted, and we need to be open to the fact that like, we are humans, that like mm-hmm. we have errors, like we get mm-hmm. it wrong.
In that, how have you learned to differentiate for yourself? Because sometimes we do get it wrong, but how do you tell the difference between, yeah, this feels like God speaking, and yeah, this just feels like this is something that I want?
I mean, I tried my best, because like I am somebody who, and we probably don't have like the hours to get into this, but I'm somebody yeah. who has the gift of prophecy, which means mm-hmm. that like, I do believe that it's so weird to say, like, I believe I hear from God, but like, yeah. I have been given, I'm given specific messages for other people that like are very clearly something they need to hear, something they need to know. And at the same time, that is a gift that you have to practice. And so to me, that looks like sitting a lot and being quiet a lot and doing a lot of listening practice. And even when you hear something, yeah. test that, because you could, like, I think our brains are very overactive. And so I could mm-hmm. be sitting there and God could say to me like Psalm 210. And it's like, that doesn't exist in the Bible, you know? And so it's like, everything has to be tested.
Yeah.
And even then, when I send a text to somebody or when I tell somebody like in a prayer session, hey, I am not in any way like going to say, this is the ultimate, this is what I know to be true. I will say, take this for what it is, sit with it. It might mean something to you. It might not mean something to you, but I just want to be the messenger to what I heard. It's a very delicate thing. That's what mm-hmm. I think. And I think that's where it's like, I don't get it right all the time. I'm sure that I don't get it all the right all the time. But like when I hear God prompt me in a direction, I will always write it down. I will revisit it. And I will, you know, wade into the things that I think he's telling me to move into, yeah. but I'm open to that ending up not being the right direction. At the same time, yeah. I don't feel like I audibly hear God a lot being like, go to this country or yeah. go here and marry, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's a still small voice in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's happened a few times. I've heard some audible things, but that is like, I can count them on this palm of my hand.
Right. What I love the most in what you said in the essence of it, it's not black and white, which we talked mm-hmm. about in the beginning. It's not black and white. There's room for error. There's room for me to be wrong. There's room for me to be right. And I think that with that mindset, we can achieve and we can do not just in the area of faith, but across the board. If we can live yeah. in a more gray area, we can show up as like more connected humans, more kind humans, more mentally sound humans. And so, yeah, that's, I love that and how you put that. And I wish that we had 3 more hours because I'd like to talk more about that, but we don't. So I know. So I think this is a good place to end.
We went everywhere.
Yeah, we went everywhere. So this was not, I don't know how I'm going to title this. So I think we're just going to Lexapro.
Everything with Hannah Brencher. Yeah.
What do you want people, like, how can people get in touch with you? How can they find your book? Because they're going to want it. Where do they find you?
Everything is over at hannahbrencher.com. We have a page over there for Fighting Forward that comes out January 5th. Yeah, Fighting Forward is available wherever books are sold. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, shop local, support your local indie. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, everybody go get the book. Hopefully by the time it comes out, I'll be done with it. Yeah. But thank you so much for being here and for being open. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.